My name's Ajahn Jayasaro. I'm from Thailand.
You can tell by the accent. Sorry, I shouldn't have interrupted.
I have a slight Ubon accent, but I'm losing it, and it's becoming much more Korat these days. if I may start on a personal note, I assisted Ajahn Pasuno for many years at Wat Nanachat, and then when he came here, I took over at Wat Nanachat as the senior monk. Although I never became the abbot, Ajahn Pasuno was the abbot all the time that I was at Wat Nanachat. I was the acting abbot. So that made it somewhat easier for me to take premature or early retirement in 2002. And I've been living in a hermitage. Some of you have been to visit me there, which is near the Khao Yai National Park, about 2 hours' drive northeast of Bangkok. Now, these days I spend most of my time alone. I have 2 teaching days a month. But in planning my life at Bak Chong, I wanted to have one particular project that was aimed directly at the welfare and the benefit of the Thai people, Thai society in general, to complement the increased time that I would have for my own practice. And my area of interest has long been that of education. So I have been involved in what's loosely called the Buddhist education movement in Thailand over the past few years. So I'll perhaps let you know a little bit about what I've been doing and what's going on in that country. If you were to read some accounts of merchants from England, from Holland, from France in the 18th century, even early 19th century, visiting Thailand, Southeast Asia, they write in their journals that they're astounded by the incredibly high literacy rates in Thailand. Nowhere in the Western world were there comparable literacy rates at that time. And in those days, the education was given by the monks in the monasteries. And by all standards, certainly for the boys, it was a very successful system. But changes took place, and in the late in the 19th century, when Thailand was something of a buffer state between 2 major colonial powers, Britain, which colonized Burma, present-day Malaysia, and France, which colonized what is now referred to as Laos and Cambodia, Vietnam. Thailand was in the middle, and there was an effort by King Mongkut, the 4th king, to sort of rationalize the Buddha's teachings or to de-emphasize the kind of superstitious or paranormal aspects of the tradition, to garner respect from the Western powers as a means of bolstering the reputation of Thailand in the, we could call it in those days, the international community. By the time you reach the late 19th century, the reign of King Chulalongkorn, the fifth king, then the view is that Thailand must become a nation state. Although we have the term Thailand, the idea of a country in the way that we're familiar with it in the West is a relatively recent invention. For hundreds of years, thousands of years, Thailand was really a conglomeration, a number of what we call mueang, or cities or states, which all owed allegiance to larger states. So in Thailand, personal relationships have always taken precedent over structures. So you'd have the king, let's say from the time of Ayutthaya or from Bangkok, you have you have the king with a large number of concubines, and then you have various towns and mueang who have relationships with the center, with the king, based on the paying of tribute, and often the Jiao Mueang, the leader of this mueang, would send one of his daughters to become a concubine of the king. So that's why he had so many concubines. Now it might happen that that concubine might particularly capture the heart of the king, and as a result have a child, and then the relationship between the king and that particular mueang would become very strong, even though it was geographically some way apart, whereas a closer mueang might not have that same personal connection. So there's this kind of floating, changing, uncertain relationship between various centres of power and the king and the court in Bangkok. So a number of these mueang, which we say, well, they're in Thailand, but actually they wouldn't just pay tribute to Bangkok, they would also pay tribute to Peking. So they would not necessarily consider themselves part of a nation state. People wouldn't consider themselves as Thai people. their allegiance would be to their boss. And so Thai people, it's always been a kind of a mercenary kind of society in which you always look for who's the most powerful protector, and then you align yourself with that person. And same with the spirit gods, people would have particular spirits which they would pay respects to, and then maybe if you had a bad harvest and the village down the road who had a different spirit, they had a better harvest, and you throw your spirit and you take on their spirit. So all these kinds of patterns you can now see in modern Thailand in the political landscape, but they've just been kind of transferred into a modern idiom. Anyway, part and parcel of the reforms in the 19th century were the effort to create uniformity. And so the Thammayut sect in the monastic order, which was established by King Mongkut before he became king, was used as the spearhead to... that's not really a good word, is it? The vanguard of the moves to create uniformity throughout the country and in the Sangha, in the different areas of the country, which had widely varying practices and customs, and also to develop an education system. And so experts were brought in from European countries to run the civil service, to run the army, and as advisors in the education department. Most of the schools, the first generation of schools in Thailand, were built on land donated by monasteries and on right next to the monastery. So a very close relationship. And still in many schools, you'll see this in Thailand today. So the schools were built right next to the monastery on land offered by the monastery, given up by the monastery, and monks would have a regular teaching role in those schools. But Western methods became more and more the vogue and the accepted norm and the thing to be aspired to. And so the kind of rote learning and the kind of traditional Western style education became widespread, and the role of the monks became less and less. And so things have gone on in this way. Now, in the beginning, in late 19th century and through the 20th century, part of the policy of Catholic Church is to establish high-quality schools in the country to attract the elite and the wealthy. And this led to considerable political change in Vietnam, for instance, where during the Vietnam War period, a country which was predominantly Buddhist had a government which was predominantly Christian, with very close links with the United States. And you remember the Buddhist monks who cremated themselves. That wasn't, as some people may still believe, anti-war protests, but was due to the fact that the Christian government was forbidding celebration of Visakha Puja and other Buddhist holidays. But in Thailand, the political repercussions have been much less. But what has been the case is that until the recent educational changes, in which has seen a huge number of international schools being built in Thailand, then most people with money and social status will send their children to Catholic schools. And having completed their education in Catholic school, will then go and do their degrees overseas. Or the very wealthy perhaps would send their children overseas from the age of 8 or 9. Now, these people return to Thailand, nominally Buddhist in most cases, but with only the most superficial understanding of what Buddhism is about. And certainly, although culturally Buddhist, their intellectual life, their worldview, the way they look at things like development and the future of Thailand, all these things are almost untouched by Buddhist ideas. And returning to Thailand and going into powerful and prestigious positions, they take ideas about society and economy and so on and so forth, which have been absorbed from Harvard Business School or Wharton or MIT, rather than Sarnath or Sarvati. Now, I've... Pardon?
An Oxford University.
Yes, I'm speaking to an American audience, so. So I've always felt that this is a great shame, and it's always kind of rankled with me a little bit. And my first stab at doing something about it, and that's not a very good word either. My first attempt to do something about this about 15 years ago, on a couple of occasions, I went to the East Coast and I took a bunch of Thai students from Harvard and MIT and various institutions on a hiking retreat in Arcadia. So it's kind of like really relaxed. We do some walking and some camping and chatting and meditating together. But it just wasn't possible for me to do that on a regular basis. But it did. I mean, at very least, there are one or two monks in Thailand now who started off on those retreats in Arcadia. Thai monks, but. In terms of doing something a little bit more systematic, then is it interested in the idea of integrating Buddhist teachings into Thai society. Now, as I say, Thailand is a proud Thai nation. I think proud in the sense that people are happy to be Buddhist. But there's often a disjunction between their allegiance to Buddhism and the way that they think about the world and they think about life, and particularly in the educated strata of society. So I think where do you start? My answer was you start kindergarten and primary school. And it so happens that one of my students is the headmistress, Kru On, headmistress of a kindergarten school, and at that time just starting a primary school, who was dissatisfied with the teaching and the education that she was able to give to her children. And after doing one or two retreats with me and other members of her family, then this idea of trying to increase and create something that was more Buddhist, so-called. At that time, and this is some, I don't know, 10, 15 years ago, 10 years or more ago now, there was one school in Bangkok called Rung Arun, which had been blazing a path and inspired by Jaukun Prayut, Payuto, who, again, some of you may have heard of, the author of that book, Constitution for Living. So my own input has not been primarily in teaching children. I do next to no teaching of children. I go and visit the school every now and again and give a little talk to the children. But my main work has been in trying to evolve an idea, a concept, a philosophy for Buddhist education and teaching and counseling the teachers. So the fundamental idea underlying it, and one which I've referred to in a couple of talks and conversations that we've had here last couple of days, is is the idea that the religions of the world are of a different, basic, different species, if you like, and the religions that grew up in the Middle East, the great monotheistic traditions, are essentially belief systems, and we're so accustomed to the idea of religions as being belief systems, we just think, well, that's what a religion is. It's noticeable in the last few years to the extent to which the word faith is used as a synonym for religion. So these days it's most common to refer to the Christian faith rather than the Christian religion, the Islamic faith, the Jewish faith. So that in itself points to the fact that we think faith and religion in interchangeable terms. And so inevitably, people assume that Buddhism is also a belief system. So, oh, you're a Buddhist? Really? What do you believe in? You see? I'm sure all of you have had to answer that question. So the assumption is it's basically the same animal. It's the same kind of thing, but you don't believe in God or Jesus. You believe in Buddha, something like that. And my contention is that Buddhism is a different kind of religion. It's a different species, as it were, and it's not a belief system, it's an education system. And this is why I think if you open the Majjhima Nikaya or one of the suttas and you compare it with the Old Testament, the New Testament, you see there's something radically different here. This is a different kind of book altogether. its its aims and its everything about it is quite different. And so, if we look at the Buddha's teaching, the Eightfold Path, it's often abbreviated to the threefold training of sila, samadhi, panya. Now that word sikha, trai sikha, oti sikha, is the root of the Thai word for education, which is siksa. So siksa comes from sikha. So we can say sila, samadhi, and panya is the threefold education, if we like. So education here meaning both learning, absorbing information, and then acting upon it. So if there's only learning, absorbing information, and then stopping, then that's not a true education. So if we say that Buddhism is an education system, then I would say that it is the most comprehensive, the perfect education system that the world has ever seen, because it is able to take someone from the lowest level. I mean, we have examples like Angulimala, who killed 999 people, to the highest level possible, arahantship. So it is the means, the vessel, the vehicle of transformation. And this is the, I think, the salient characteristic of Buddhism. Most religious traditions, I think, would agree, give some very inspiring ideals. They tell you how you should be. And when you're at how a human being should be, sounds wonderful. But then you flick through and you try to find the directions, the user manual to get from where you are now to where you should be. Maybe that bit sort of fell out because you can't find it. So you feel you're hopeless, and you feel despair and guilt because you can't be the person your religion tells you should be. So Buddhism is putting much more emphasis on the nitty-gritty, down to earth, and what it's like right now and where you go from here. So intensely practical and I would say thoroughly comprehensive, systematic, measured presentation of the education, the training, the cultivation, transformation of the human being. And in our Theravada tradition, as you know, we in comparing now with the Mahayana tradition, for instance, the humanity of the Buddha is central to our understanding of Buddhism. If you compare the Mahaparinibbana Sutta of Theravada, of Mahayana, is an interesting thing which is not to be found in the Mahayana version, and that is the Buddha's dysentery before he died. There's the Mahayana don't find that inspiring, that the Buddha had dysentery before he died. But for us, it's part and parcel of his humanity. So the Buddha experienced, realized Nibbana, we can say, as a representative of the human race. Certainly he was an exceptional or unique human being in terms of his past and the accumulation of spiritual merits and barami over countless lifetimes. But when it was all said and done, he was a human being who got old, got sick, and died. And so his for that reason, his enlightenment is clearly seen to be a proof of the capacity of the human being for enlightenment. So he was a representative. He proved this is what human beings can do. This is the highest thing that a human being can attain. Now, if we have confidence in that, in faith in the Buddha, that implies faith in the capacity of the human being for enlightenment, which in turn implies faith in our own capacity for enlightenment. So when we say we have faith in the Buddha, we have faith in our own capacity for enlightenment. Years ago, I was visiting Ajahn Munindo. I'd been in Thailand for 6 years, first visit back to England, and we went to a Visakha Puja celebration in London and caught the train back to west of England. It's about 9 or 10 o'clock at night, walking along this lonely road, and then this car pulled in, and all these young people jumped out of the car, ran over to us, and I was wondering what was going to happen. And then they said, what do you believe in? They were born-again Christians. But the thing was, I didn't know how to answer. I'd been a monk for 6 years, and I'd never conceived my spiritual life in terms of what I believed in. And I was, ask him, he's the Ajahn, so... So this is one of the spiritual and monastic virtues and that I had learned is passing the buck to the teacher. But now, I then that made me think about it, and so my answer now is, I believe in my capacity for enlightenment. I can't prove that. Nobody can prove it fully until they become arahants themselves. But that's something that we do take on trust. So the Buddha proved human capacity for enlightenment, and we believe in our own capacity for enlightenment. And then we have the enlightened masters, the arahants, from the time of the Buddha to the present day, who are proving, well, it wasn't just a one-off. If there was just the Buddha, we might think, well, he was unique. And, there's a huge gap between us and him, but thankfully we have men and women from all over the world who have realized the highest goals of Buddhism and prove it wasn't just the Buddha. This is something which is open to all human beings, men and women, Europeans, Caucasians, Asians, everyone. So the Eightfold Path, the Threefold Training, this is the transformative force. And so the idea, at least underlying my understanding of Buddhist education, and this isn't the view on Buddhist education, okay? I'm just one person who's involved in this. This is my view, that the teachings of the Buddha provide the complete education of every sphere, every area of human life, and if taken in full and taken to its full extent, leads to enlightenment. But that it is possible to create an education system for people who will live in the world, live as householders, not necessarily wanting to become monks and nuns, but one which is consistent with, compatible with, one which is derived from the basic principles of the threefold training. So in Thailand, this is the general, I would say, general agreement that Buddhist education must be based on the threefold training of sila, samadhi, and panya. Now, I myself have not tended to use that threefold system so much in explaining it because of difficulty in vocabulary. So if you say sila, morality, and you say samadhi, and you say wisdom, the samadhi is the difficult one because people just assume that it means it's about meditation. Whereas in fact, in the threefold training, samadhi is like the leader of the group. Or let's say, worldly analogy, let's say you've got a really charismatic singer, and you've got a large backing group. You know, often the posters and everything will say, I don't know, Michael Jackson or somebody, but in fact there's about 10 or 20, 30 other people who are playing all the instruments, and which without whom he wouldn't be able to make a very good sound. And the idea similar, I'm suggesting, with samadhi. It's not sila and then samadhi meaning meditation, wisdom. Samadhi is a representative term of the whole sphere of what these days sometimes called emotional development of emotional intelligence, or in a more traditional idiom, say the gradual wearing away, abandonment of unwholesome dhammas and development of wholesome dhammas. And then the wisdom coming separately. Now, in Thailand, you find many parents with a lot of hesitation. Here's the word Buddhist education. They assume something similar to the Christian schools. Instead of singing hymns, you do a bit more chanting and meditate a bit in the morning, and it's basically a Buddhist translation of a Christian form. So this kind of, when they hear it's based on sila, samadhi, panya, then all these fears come up. People think, yeah, well, it'd be nice to have a son who was well-mannered and virtuous and peaceful, but, you know, how is he going to survive in the real world? This is the fear that many parents have. The other day we were talking about, I was asked by Ajahn Gunawutto about a point I'd made about Western ideas and things sort of being smuggled under the radar into Western society. Now, to point out to Thai people, this idea is based on a very Western concept that good equals stupid. Yeah. From the time of not the Buddhist Enlightenment, the Western Enlightenment. Separation. Well, religion is sort of internal; it's your private matter, and is the sphere of the inner world. And in the outer world, in the real world, you use scientific, rational principles. So the irrational you keep for the inner world, and the rational for the outer world. And so this idea, this idea of being otherworldly, and of being too pure for the world, and if you become too good, then you get taken advantage of, and people trample all over you because you can't see their cunning. The basic idea is evil people are more intelligent than good people. Just look at modern culture everywhere. It's the same. This idea that it's good. This is kind of a little bit kind of dull and naive about good people, and that idea, unfortunately, is there in Thai society as well. I'm saying, look at the word for goodness in Thai language. It's derived from the word kusala, kuson. And what's the etymology of the word kusala? It comes from the word for intelligent, clever, sharp, smart. So the basic Buddhist idea is not that good equals stupid or naive, but good equals smart and sharp and knowing what's what. So in the Buddhist sense, if you're teaching children to be good, you are simultaneously teaching them to be smart. And if they're good but not smart, then they're not really good. If they're smart and not good, they're not really smart. So trying to face up to and to deal with this these kind of cultural and mishmash and misunderstandings. Nobody's interrupted me yet. Does anybody want to say anything before? Shall I just carry on? Okay. So often in parents considering Buddhist education for their children, usually one of the parents, and it's usually the mother who's very keen, and the father is the one who's saying, well, look, yeah, it's all very well, but, you know, he's got to make a living, very competitive world, and so on and so forth. So I'm continually having to point out that you don't have to make a sacrifice in that way, quite the opposite. So I have a whole range of these examples and results of various studies that have taken place. I think some of you may be familiar with Daniel Goleman's books on emotional intelligence, and one of the ones that I repeat again and again is this famous cookie test, which took place a long time ago now, where the teacher, there's a room with a hidden camera and a number of children, 4 years old, they're all given IQ tests, and then one by one, put in the room, the teacher says, here's a cookie, delicious cookie, it's for you, I've got to go out and do something, I'll be back in 10 minutes. If you eat the cookie, that's all you get. If you keep the cookie you've got, you'll get another one. So the child has a dilemma. It's a really delicious cookie. He wants to eat the cookie, but if he eats the cookie, that's all he'll get. So what do the kids do? Some of the kids just have no impulse control. They can't help it. They just eat the cookie. Others close their eyes. Others sort of hide it. Others sort of walk up and down. And so they note all this down, and which kids can and cannot delay gratification and to be patient with this desire, because their intelligence tells them that it makes sense to be patient and not to follow the impulse of the moment. Many years later, at the age of, 17, same children take the SAT exams, and then they look for correlations between IQ and SAT success and delayed gratification success at 4 and SAT success. There's zero correlation between the IQ at 4 and SAT, but there's an incredibly strong correlation between kids who can be patient about eating their cookie at 4 and academic success at 17. This kind of test has been replicated on many occasions. There's a new book out that some people may have read, Malcolm Gladwell's latest book called Outliers. It has 5 stars from Ajahn Pasno, Ajahn Amaro, and Ajahn Jayasaro, so it's highly, highly recommended. There's one chapter when he talked, Why are Asian kids better at maths than American kids? And he's, in his usual very entertaining way, he goes into linguistics and the differences between rice farming and wheat farming and all kinds of things you would think would have no bearing at all. But one point I'll give you here is he says every year they have these kind of maths Olympics. Kids from all over the world fill in this same set of maths questions, which are compulsory. And accompanying the compulsory maths questions, there are a whole list of questions about the children themselves, their background, their lives, to be able, for the scientists to be able to draw some conclusions about why children in some cultures are better at maths than others. Now, one researcher, through serendipity, just happened to notice that there was a strange correlation, and the correlation was between the number of questions that the child, the voluntary questions that the child answered, and the math score. That the more the voluntary questions the child filled in, the higher the math score. And this was so consistent that he said he could tell you who was good at maths without even looking at the math scores, the math questions. And so the idea is that someone who's willing just to be patient and do something which has no immediate kind of gratification is someone who is likely to be successful. So following on from this, they had like American and Japanese kids ask the maths questions, which they know they can't answer, and then see how long before they give up. And the Japanese child is like 40% longer than the American child. So again, reinforcing the idea that one of the main predictors of academic success is patient endurance, which is why I was saying to someone yesterday, patient endurance is not the consolation prize in spiritual life. It's the gold medal. You know, if you get most people say, yes.
What was the book?
It's called Outliers, Outliers, by a man called Malcolm Gladwell. Yeah. And so. So this, you know, is an example I give to that an education system which is giving precedence and importance to qualities such as patience is one which is not making kids sort of saintly and dull and stupid and doomed to, an unsuccessful life in worldly terms, but it's something which is... of use in any walk of life that they should choose. So I think that samadhi training, I because of the misunderstandings that tend to arise, I've adopted a fourfold classification, which is also in the suttas. For four kinds of bhavana. Bhavana, incidentally, the word that's usually translated as meditation, but it means like cultivation, education, really. And so, Buddha has talked about four kinds of bhavana: two external, two internal. So these are really correspond to sila, samadhi, and panya, merely that sila is divided into two, and they're slightly different words. So instead of samadhi, it's the training of the mind or the heart. The external training, one is called, at least in the Pali, is physical, and one is moral. But how I explain it is, the first area of education is the education of the child's relationship to the physical world. Now, that begins with the child's physical body. So it would include teaching sports and exercise, nutrition, and biology, and so on. So all that. This is the area where most of the sciences that are normally taught would be taught in this sphere. And then from the immediate physical reality, their own bodies, to the world in which they live, their relationship to technology, to the internet, to money, to the physical world, their possessions, their toys, what's their relationship to those things, what's their understanding of what those things are for. And that would include traditional training, what we call sense restraint, or caring for your eyes, ears, nose, tongue, knowing how to choose which of the huge amount of sensory input is beneficial and which is not. So in these days where there is just such an information overload, having some principle of discrimination between what is beneficial and what is not, what is wholesome, what is not, is part of this kind of education. And then going outwards to finally to the relationship with the environment. And so this would include environmental science. Incidentally, at this point, when beginning the new project, which maybe go on to just to mention it in advance, the boarding school, high school boarding school project, which has just started last month, I suggested that given the fact that so few people really understand what we're trying to do in Buddhist education, it would be good idea to develop an area of excellence in the school which is not perceived as being specifically Buddhist, but which has implication. It is compatible with agrees with the kind of Buddhist education that we're interested in, and so I suggested environmental sciences. So the idea that this school will have a reputation as being an excellent school for children who want to specialise in environmental science, environmental engineering, ecology, and so on and so forth in future, so that it would have a reputation independent of the Buddhist transformational principles. And this for down-to-earth commercial reasons as much as anything else in terms of attracting parents who are still kind of hesitant about the whole Buddhist idea. The second external area, that the relationship with the social world. So the first is like the material world, second is the social world. So teaching precepts, and again, precepts are sort of interesting in that many of the areas in which the precepts, as Ajahn Amaro was talking about this morning, you know, are dealt with in the moral codes of all major religions. But the difference in Buddhism is that sila is taken to be a kind of training or education, rather than a set of rules which are imposed upon us from above, and which we need to obey. And if we obey, we get a reward, and if we don't, we get punished. So there's no reward or punishment here, but the precepts are taken on voluntarily, and this you know, is sometimes overlooked in the ceremony just now. It's always the lay Buddhists have to request the precepts, not like Ajahn Amaro says, okay, sit straight, now I'm going to give you the precepts. You have to ask. If you don't ask, he won't give them to you, okay? And this is there's a point of Dhamma here, that for the precepts to be a form of education and training, they have to be voluntary. If you feel that they've been imposed upon you, then yes, you may not kill living beings, you may not steal, but it won't be sila in the Buddhist sense, because sila needs to lead on to samadhi and banya, and it won't perform that function if there's not this wholehearted interest and commitment to the precepts, which must come within. So sila is both the inner virtue and inner intention, and also its external expression. So I've sat down with children and I said, okay, let's imagine that you could change the world. You had a magic wand and you could make the world any way you wanted it. You could make the school, your family. What would be an ideal world in your opinion? What would it be like? And you can sit with children and go through this, and it's pretty consistent what you come up with. Well, we'd like to live in a place where nobody hurts each other, nobody hits each other, nobody pinches each other, nobody pushes somebody in the back, nobody lies to each other, nobody swears at each other, nobody speaks hurtfully, where you feel safe and secure, where you feel warmth and friendliness. And so these kinds of needs and desires, I would say, were universal. But the next question is, okay, if that's the kind of community and society we want, what, practically speaking, can we do to move towards that, at least a little bit? What kinds of tools, techniques do we need? So from there, you go on to this recognition that we can't forbid ourselves from getting angry with somebody. You can't tell yourself, today I'm not going to get angry with anybody. But you can say, today, even if I get angry with somebody, I won't hit them. So there is a distinction between the mind and body and speech. You can use the intention to refrain, the ability to say no, in other words, to help to create the kind of environment which everyone agrees is the kind of society and community we want to live in. So let's say you live in that kind of community and trust arises and a sense of safety. You know, even if somebody every now and again loses their temper with you, maybe not very happy with you, sulking a bit or whatever, at the very least, you don't have to be looking behind your back and worrying that they're going to hit you or stab you or do something nasty or tell lies about you. So this basic sense of stability, safety, is dependent on a community willing to exercise some control over their body and speech. So you can lead children towards an understanding of precepts in this way, rather than Buddhist says don't do this, it's bad, you know, it's bad karma. You're going to hell, you know, that kind of. In this way, precepts become kind of training. And I think apart from that, then we also need to be talking about livelihood and particularly communication. I was saying to someone today, I think myself, my generation, you know, we had this feeling as monks that if you practiced, you kept the Vinaya and you meditated every day, you were very mindful and you reflected on anicchang, dukkhang, anatta, then basically everything would kind of just sort of slot into... Did you have that kind of feeling? I had that kind of feeling, slot into place. And then after a while, I think it's kind of a rude awakening for many monastic communities that, you know, there can be real problems in communication between different monasteries and monks and monasteries, and that communication skills are not the naturally arising fruit of mindfulness practice. Yeah, that was a revelation, really. I just thought, well, you know, if you have a good, you've got metta and you're kind, and you're all living together with the same goals. Yeah, why can't you communicate well? I mean, what's the problem? Some communities have had really serious problems with this. But generally, the realization, these are skills. This is an education. This is something you have to put effort into. Some people find it easier than others. And so in this education, Buddhist education, I'm keen on putting a lot of effort into wise, skillful means of communication. And so those are the two external, education of one's relationship to the physical world, beginning with the physical body and going right out to the environment, and life in society and one's relationship to other people. So the curriculum in Thailand is to a large degree determined by the Ministry of Education. You don't have that much wriggle worm. You can... you can cheat a bit. You know, like they say, should be English. Okay, well, English lessons you can teach Dhamma in English, for instance. So you know, that's a sort of a way around it. I guess with maths, you could teach like the Four Noble Truths and the Five. If you've got the five spiritual faculties and the five and the seven Bojangas, then what have you? You've got 12. Very nice things, and you can sort of get around it a bit, but you do have to fit a certain amount of things in, and so they you're not neglecting all those. I say like physics and chemistry and biology; these will always go in that first area, and social studies and history and so on would go into the life in society, and. I'm saying, like with history, you know, do like a history of greed, hatred, and delusion, you know, a history of kindness, you know, a history of self-sacrifice. And so you can take Dhamma themes and go through the same kind of historical material, but with a different frame on it, and one which is compatible with the kind of qualities you're trying to promote. As Thai children tend to be very shy generally, I'm keen on promoting drama and role play and things where children are expressing themselves and learning empathy through acting and that kind of thing. So those are the two external. Then the internal ones, the training, the education of the heart. So this is the whole area of abandoning the unwholesome and developing the wholesome. So mindfulness and samadhi play a central role in that, of course. But then there are all the other positive qualities of kindness and contentment and perseverance and patience and all these things. Now, I think that teachers in every education system would surely say, yes, we would like our pupils to be patient and courteous and kind and so on and so forth. But my criticism would be that there's no, it's not systematic, and that I think teachers kind of hope that it will just, these things will just kind of evolve naturally over the course of an education, and I don't think they do. And I think that it's important to create a new, if I can use the word, paradigm, in which those become goals of education. So not just that you can pass exams and you know what's the capital city of Paraguay and between which two states does the Red River flow and things like that, but you feel that the child has should have developed within his time at school powers of patience and endurance and contentment and the ability to deal wisely and constructively with negative emotions. The child knows how to deal with sorrow and grief and depression and anxiety and fear, and knows how to develop within himself positive emotions. So it's intelligence within the realm of emotions. And it's here that the mindfulness practice and samadhi are given that precedence, because they are the real the engines of that kind of change. But so bringing up these kind of qualities and saying this is part of education. You know, in your first year, you should be developing patience as an educational goal, not while you're studying. You should, you know, it'd be helpful if you can be patient with this and persevere. So the fourth area, the area of wisdom development, and I'm trying to develop with teachers and a sort of curriculum for teaching thinking skills, creative and critical thinking skills, which, no, not specifically Buddhist, but just the ability to think. And it's often observed in Thailand that children don't ask questions very much. You know, if you go into a classroom in England, America, you say, you ask questions, anyone just harass me, like this. And in Thailand, it's really just like this, you know. But actually that that in itself is misleading. You see, you can't jump to conclusions, because if you ask people to write their questions down anonymously, you get great questions, really good questions. It's not that they're not thinking and that they're just kind of, you know. It's just that in that culture, people don't generally feel comfortable about exposing themselves in that way with people that they don't know. But if you see Thai people who are like all friends together, you can't stop them talking. And but they have to feel that kind of sense of security and warmth before they'll open up in that way. So anonymous questions works very well. But I also, you had a kind of insight, if you like, that what I was, I'm always trying to think, what am I assuming here? You know, I think it's a very good question for me. What's my assumption here? My assumption is that asking questions is just, again, just kind of a natural thing that everybody knows how to do. But I thought, no. So I'm asking the teachers to, like, get a complex picture like this and ask each child to ask 20 questions about that picture. And you don't have, there's no answers involved. I'm not interested in answers. I'm interested in questions. The questions are the answers, in other words. And so, you know, taking from journalism, what, where, when, why, how. And so ask five what questions about that picture, five when questions, five where questions. Starting off that the ability to ask questions itself is not something that you can take for granted. So using a lot of Western materials, stuff from books printed in England, America, about great stuff about development of thinking skills. And then, but there's a specifically Buddhist form of thinking skill, which we call Yoniso Manisikara, which would be sort of added on top. And Yoniso Manisikara is usually translated as skillful reflection, wise reflection. So there are two kinds of Yoniso Manisikara. One is the kind of thinking, reflection, looking at an issue in a way which will reduce unwholesome dhammas or replace them with wholesome dhammas. So if you're thinking in a very negative way and you're getting very angry, then stopping and developing reflection on, say, loving kindness and compassion and so on, would be a use of Yoniso Manisikara. It's using the thinking process to challenge or to replace an unwholesome stream of thought with a wholesome stream of thought. So if the mind is very obsessed with sensual, sexual matters, then bringing up in mind reflections on the unattractive aspects of the physical body to bring the mind back to the middle way. So these are examples of Yoniso Manisikara. If you're very lazy, I know you're not, but let's just for the purpose of argument, let's say you're very lazy, then reflections on death are very useful. Bring up a sense of the value of time. The other kind of Yoniso Manisikara is the reflection on the way things are. On impermanence, on, as I just said, mine, on the unsatisfactory nature of existence, on the selfless nature of existence. These, using the thinking discursive powers to reflect upon the way things are. So one form of Yoniso Manisikara is seeking to replace negative, unwholesome thoughts and emotions with positive thoughts and emotions. The other one, directly reflecting on the way things are. Highest form of wisdom, of course, vipassana. Now, something that sometimes the teachers and people at the school, you know, get really kind of inspired and everything. So the ironic thing is, I'm the one who's saying, look, we don't want to turn these children into monks and nuns. They're school children, okay? You know, it's not like everything you have to say has to have like a Dhamma angle. You know, it's like, you say, but you know what? Yeah, I can teach that, but you know, where's the Buddhist angle? It's not you have to have like a Buddhist angle or a little kind of Buddhist, this, what I'm telling you here teaches this, you know, like an Aesop's fable. It's, you know, it's more the whole structure and the whole emphasis on developing a rounded education of every area of life, not just one particular area, particularly the intellectual area. But over and apart from the content of what's being taught, it's the relationships in the school, and the kind of slogan that I developed for the school is, we're all students. There are three kinds of students here. One kind of student is called school child. One kind of student is called a teacher, and one kind of student is called the parent. But everyone here is a student. Everyone here is learning. And with teachers, you're still learning how to be a good teacher. There's still more to learn. And parents are learning how to be good parents. And the idea of creating a community of on the basis of kalyana mitata, of good friendship. I'm speaking for what I know about the English system, where sort of business model has been taken into education. And so the idea is that the parent is a consumer and the schools are service providers. And so everyone has to sort of fight there and to get the best deal for them, for themselves. And you have league tables, which schools. And so teachers are extremely frustrated in England in that the well-being, the financial well-being of the school is directly related to their league position in the league table, which is measured by academic performance and exams. And so teaching becomes narrower and narrower, that only children are taught to pass exams. And a lot of the non-measurable aspects of education are falling away because schools can't afford, teachers can't afford to spend time on those things. So I think, yeah, and this is again this kind of system, you know, being imported into other countries, unfortunately, and Thailand's one of them. But the Buddhist idea is that parents and teachers have to be on the same wavelength, and particularly in Buddhist schools, where if the school is trying to instill some kinds of virtues and emotional management skills and so on, then the child goes home and the parents are modeling exact opposites, then, you know, it's not going to work. And, you know, that is often children that have problems at school that I've seen almost always. It's something at home. The school that I've been involved is a private school, and that means that you can you have quality control over the teachers to a certain extent, which was not this is the problem in a public school, that you wouldn't be able to do that. But even in the private school, it's not always so easy. When we were first having meetings about this, we were saying, well, what do we expect from teachers? So the agreement was 5 precepts and at least 1 meditation retreat a year. So when they brought this up with the teachers, then there was a split. The elder teachers all thought that the meditation retreats should be compulsory. And all the younger teachers said, you know, that's not right. It should be voluntary. You shouldn't be forced to do a meditation retreat. And so there was quite a debate about this. So I was the chairman. So, you know, this group says meditation retreat should be compulsory for everyone once a year. And all the people over here said they should be voluntary. You shouldn't be able to force them. So I was the one who had the casting vote. So I said, I think it would be too extreme to make it compulsory for everyone. I think it should only be compulsory for the people who don't volunteer. And so that passed, and that's our stand. So when I get back next week, next week it's the annual teacher meditation retreat. And now, as part of this sort of outreach program, there are teachers from other schools that come and join in. And, no, I've got it wrong. It's I do 2 retreats a year, and then this one is for lay people generally. It's in October at the end of the retreat. It's the teacher one. Yeah. So. There's a lot more. I think I'll stop here and. We can have some more conversation and chat.